This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As I went walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me an endless skyway. I saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me.
Everybody sing it.
This land is your land. This land is mine.
California,
California,
New York Island,
New York Island,
Redwood Forest,
Redwood Forest,
Gulf Stream waters,
Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
I roamed and I rambled and I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sand. Now sing it pretty.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
The sun came shining, and I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving, and the dust clouds rolling. The fog was lifting, and the voice was chanting.
This land was made for you and me.
One more time.
This land is yours.
This is a Building Bridges, your Community and Labor Report special. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash. Join us today on a special program in celebration of Pete Seeger's 85th birthday on May 3rd. Pete Seeger has been on the forefront of the labor movement, the struggles for civil rights, the peace and anti-war movements, and the fight for a clean world. We recorded this program on May 1st, May Day.
We're just very pleased to have you with us. We thought that it would be appropriate to look at May Day and I guess some of your experiences and understanding of labor, etc., within that context, if that's okay.
I don't want to disappoint people, but I am not sure how or what I would sing if I were singing at a May Day parade now. It's nice to sing an old labor song like the Internationale, especially in French. It sings very well in French, but the English is horrible.
Why is that?
Well, it's stilted and everything. Translations don't usually work in music. What is a great song in the original language is a second-rate song or a third-rate song in a translation. But there are great labor songs, of course. Which Side Are You On? And We Shall Not Be Moved, and so on. I'm sure there are great labor songs in countries all around the world.
Why would you not be so sure about what labor song to sing today Is that got something to do with where you think the workers' movement or the organized labor movement is today?
I wish that Tony Mazzocchi, one of the leaders of the chemical workers' union, was still alive, because he was pushing to have unions get involved in what is sometimes called the environmental movement. He says the people who control the country, the billionaires, are doing terrible things, and they're getting away with it because labor is not opposed to them. In fact, a lot of labor unions says, "Oh, I don't like environmentalists. They take away jobs." There was a politician here in the Hudson Valley, Schermerhorn, once was passing out leaflets. "Are you out of a job and hungry? Eat an environmentalist."
Pete, we've moved away from celebrating May Day in this country. In fact, we've never celebrated as much as, paradoxically, in other parts of the world, because May Day did start here. But perhaps you could tell us a bit about the way May Day was celebrated a while back and what it means to you.
Way back in the 30s, when I first marched in the May Day parade, there were like 100,000 people, and these were the days of what they called the Popular Front. Father Divine, the gospel preacher, was in it, and numerous other people. It was a very musical thing. I'll never forget a Ukrainian-American chorus singing Ukrainian songs in beautiful harmony as they walked down the street. It echoed between the buildings, about 100 people singing in Ukrainian.
And what does May Day mean to you?
Well, it's part of history, and you and I are all part of history, too. We wouldn't be here if it wasn't for history. One can go back even further when May Day was a time you danced around the maypole. Right now, I think it's a way for people to remember that the problems the human race faces are going to have to be solved by the whole human race. They're not going to be solved by one country or an alliance of countries. It's going to be the United Nations, but really turn the United Nations into what it should be, not just a debating society. And incidentally, have you heard of a fellow? He wants to change the United Nations rules so that if there's a real majority for something, this would become the law of the world. And the idea that five big countries can veto something that the rest of the United Nations want. Of course, he says big compromise in the American Constitution was having two houses of Congress. One was the favorite of the rich people, and the other was the favorite of the poor people. The proposal for the United Nations is that there are three ways of voting. One would be one vote per country. That's the way it is now. So little Costa Rica gets one vote and big China gets one vote. The second way of voting should be one vote per person. So Costa Rica would get a couple of million votes and China would get over a billion votes. And the third way would be the GDP of a country, the gross domestic product of the country. This really amounts to $1 per vote. And if a resolution passed all three ways, then it becomes law for the world. But if it doesn't pass all three ways, then it does not become a law. It has to go back to the beginning. And this makes sense to me.
So the theme of universality, there must be a cross-border movement. Yeah. There must be the internationalization. I guess we go back to the international. There must be that unified cross the world.
Well, I think they made a big mistake back in 1892. They made it official. You make a song official, and it's like putting it in a straitjacket. The words were written in 1871 by a man who was got elected the mayor of his district in Paris. He was a textile worker, Eugène Potier. And he wrote the song just as the Paris Commune was falling, surrounded by the guns of all the rest of Europe, confidently calling on working people the world over to unite, saying it's the final battle. I think it's a mistake. There'll always be struggle. And to think that heaven on earth is going to come, there'll be a final battle, that's the foolishest thing. When you die, you'll go to heaven where everything is happy. Potier did live. He was in hiding. If he'd been discovered, he would have been killed right away in the month of May, 1871. And he somehow got to England and then to USA. He lived in Newark 6 years. Finally, there was an amnesty campaign in England. Victor Hugo was one of the leaders of it. amnesty for the communards, and some thousands of people returned to France in 1880, about 10 years later. And Pottier was now old, and on his deathbed, his fellow workers presented him with a printed volume of poems he'd written all his life, Chants Révolutionnaires, revolutionary songs. And a copy of this volume, some 8 months later, fell into the hands of a young man named Pierre Dejeter, who led a chorus in his factory, and he put a melody to it. Pretty good melody. Really, quite a good melody.
De brûle les dames de la terre, de brûle les forces de la faim, par les entonnons sans la terre, c'est l'éruption de la fin. Tout passé fait l'entrable rasa, tout le soir, debout, debout. Le monde va changer la base, nous ne sommes rien, soyons tous. C'est la lutte finale, reprends-nous et demain. La guerre nationale sera le jour humain. C'est la lutte finale, reprends-nous et demain. La guerre nationale sera le jour humain. Wake up, you prisoners of hunger. The world is changing at the base. We who have been nothing will be everything. Of the past, we shall make a clean slate. Still speaks French, though. He says, it's the final battle. Then he says, we need no supreme saviors, no God, no Caesar. Producers, save yourselves. Heat up your own forge. Soufflons nous-mêmes notre forge. Blow upon the forge and make it hot. Beat on the iron while it is hot. Il n'est pas de sauve suprême, ni Dieu, ni César, ni Tudrin. Producte, sauvons-nous nous-mêmes, décrétant le salut commun, pour que le vol rende de gorge, pour tirer l'esprit du cachot, soufflant nous-mêmes notre forge, battant le fer quand il est chaud. Et le lieu finale, groupons-nous et demain. L'internationale sera le genre humain. C'est le lutte finale, groupons-nous et demain. L'internationale sera le genre humain. I won't sing all six verses, but it says, the kings intoxicate us with gun smoke. If they insist upon making heroes of us, they will learn that our bullets are for our own generals. Workers, peasants, are we all. The world belongs to everyone. How many feed upon our flesh? But if one day these buzzards, these vultures would all disappear, the sun will shine always. Ouvriers, paysans, nous sommes. le grand parti des travailleurs. La terre n'appartient qu'aux hommes. Voici ira loger ailleurs. Combien de nos chasseurs épaissent, mais si les corbeaux, les vautours, un de ces matins disparaissent, le soleil brillera toujours. C'est le lutte finale, groupons-nous et demain, l'internationale sera le jour romain. Reprends-nous et demain, l'internationale sera le jour romain.
And the song rapidly spread throughout France, and other countries got translated into Italian and German, Spanish and English. Then in 1892, they made it the official anthem of the socialist movement. I'm rather disapproving of the word the, T-H-E, and I'm very disapproving of making any one song official. Somebody wanted to make This Land Is Your Land the national anthem of USA. I said, for God's sake, no. Can't you see the Marines marching in the country saying, this land is your land, this land is my land.
Since you brought up the issues of world power, we are living in such very difficult times now, and I can't help but thinking that once people such as yourself were blacklisted from national television for essentially being unafraid to voice your opinions, and actually you were indicted for contempt of Congress at one point. How do you look at the temper of the times now and the diminution of civil liberties?
The times now are terrible, but I'd say they're terrible ever since the atom bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. Einstein at that time said, everything has changed except our way of thinking. And how do we change our way of thinking? Well, we've had some narrow escapes. As you know, General Curtis LeMay almost got the atom bomb dropped way back in 54, and Eisenhower's people said, don't do that again. And during the Bay of Pigs, he got even closer. He had 100 planes in the air with hydrogen bombs on them, and a message to all the pilots saying, communication with Washington may be cut off. In that case, take your orders directly from me. Well, it was a miracle that it didn't happen, and Kennedy's people said, don't do that again. When he retired, he ran for vice president with George Wallace in 1972. But when he died in 1990, he was still grumbling, we would have been better off if we'd had World War III in 1954. Oh, me. Military experts. Right now, in a way, I'm happy to see people realizing how dangerous the situation is. Some more stupid things done by the people in Washington, I say, thank God, maybe people will wake up and realize the danger the human race is in. And they're not just stupid people in Washington. They're stupid people who call themselves scientists. And they keep inventing new ways to kill each other. Scientists have a religious belief that an infinite increase in empirical information is a good thing. Can they prove it? Of course not. They think their decisions and actions based on observation, double-checked around the world, and then drawing logical conclusions. Well, haven't they observed their insane, power-hungry people in the world? Is it logical to put in their hands the ability to destroy the world? It's a religious belief they have. So it's a very dangerous situation, but I say, thank God more people realize how dangerous it is now. Maybe we'll end up thanking George W. Bush.
Do you think more people understand the danger of the Bush administration?
I think more and more people understand it. Somebody told me of a lifelong Republican friend she has who goes around with a button on his coat saying ABB. Anything, anybody but Bush.
I almost think we should say anything but Bush. I think that's wonderful. Maybe it's time for a song, and maybe we can play one of your songs. Maybe you can select a song that you think would be appropriate to play on this May Day.
I don't know if you can find the record. It was a song I made up 20 or more years ago called Quite Early Morning is the name of the song.
Don't you know it's darkest before the dawn? Thought keeps me moving on. If we could heed these early warnings, time is now quite early morning. So far, not enough people have heeded the early warning.
You know it's darkest before the dawn. This thought keeps me moving on. If we could heed these early warnings, the time is now quite early morning. If we could heed these early warnings, the time is now quite early morning. Some say that mankind won't long endure, but what makes them feel so doggone sure? I know that you who hear my singing could make those freedom bells go ringing. I know that you who hear my singing could make those freedom bells go ringing. And so we keep on while we live, till we have no more to give. And when these fingers can strum no longer, and the old guitar the young one stronger, and when these fingers can strum no longer, and the old guitar the young one stronger. So though it's darkest before the dawn, this thought keeps us moving on through all this world of joy and sorrow. We still can have singing tomorrows through all this world of joy and sorrow. We still can have singing tomorrow. Yes, though it's darkest before the dawn, this thought keeps us moving on. If we could heed these early warnings, the time is now quite early morning. If we could heed these early warnings, the time is now quite early morning.
I'm interested, why did you pick that song?
I say there's still a 50-50 chance that there'll be a human race here in 100 years. We've had numerous narrow escapes. I mentioned two of them. Another one that occurred 20 years ago in Russia. Colonel Stanislas Petrov, I think was his name, was in charge of monitoring the Soviet instruments that were keep their eye on the missile sites in USA. And all of a sudden, one of the missile sites lights up which supposedly meant they were sending a missile off towards the Soviet Union. But he said, how come only one of them? He said, maybe it's a mistake, because he was theoretically supposed to immediately launch an opposite strike. Well, thank God he did delay, because 5 or 10 minutes later it proved it was a mistake. It was a computer glitch. But he could right then launched World War III. And I imagine there have been other cases like this.
Pete, you're working on a new project now. I'm not quite sure what that means.
That's introduced by some people on this interesting committee called PUCLAD, Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy, PUCLAD. And they're trying to find ways in which ordinary folks like you and me can find gradual ways of cutting down the power of corporations. Well, one of the things is learning about history. For example, in the early 19th century, a state could hand out a charter to a corporation. But in 1888, the Supreme Court handed down a rule they could not take away a charter. They could only give it. But once the corporation had a charter, it was there forever. You cannot put an end to it. You can fine them, punish them, but you can't take away their charter. And corporations have just got more and more powerful as they've got bigger and bigger and bigger. So now they literally can control the world. Now, what can be done? I think we should learn from Dr. King, because who could say that riding in the front seat of the bus was so important way back in 1956 when they had the bus boycott in Montgomery? I mean, education was more important. Jobs, health, voting, lots of things were much more important. Why didn't he pick those struggles? Well, when you face an opponent over a broad front, you don't aim for your opponent's strong points. You aim for some little outpost, but you capture it. You don't just attack it, you capture it. And they won that bus boycott unexpectedly, thanks to the Warren Court and the press and so on, a lot of things. He was a master of words, but he also knew how to bring people together. And he kept the cautious, conservative ones working with the angry, radical ones who wanted to throw things. And he said, look, we'll have a retreat. It may take a day or two or even three, but we must learn to work together. And now, one of you asked questions of this group. Now, this group asked questions of the first group. And we'll have to answer each other's questions. Because if we can stick together, we can win. But we know if we don't stick together, we cannot win. And I feel that the whole world has got to learn from Dr. King. Right now, it may be that Bush has got so many tricks up his sleeve, he'll find a way to get reelected. But he won't be in such a strong position as he was in before.
Do you think that labor, that the workers as a group, is playing the kind of role that you would like to see in questioning the Bush administration? Is the working class asserting the power that it should to discipline government and harness it to its own ends?
Well, obviously, there's got to be a world continual meeting of working class groups, all parts of the world. That's why I'm in favor of the United Nations. These should be working class groups from small little countries in the third world and bigger countries in Europe and Asia, especially. And if we really start talking with each other, we'll find there's lots of give and take, lots of compromises, but we'll find ways we can work towards some kind of world consensus. But it's not easy, needless to say.
You're essentially an optimist.
Well, I say there's a chance. I say there's a 50-50 chance.
You're a pragmatist.
If we work towards it.
God only knows what the future's going to be. All I know is that I was actually surprised that there's still a world here 58 years after Hiroshima. 59, it'll be this summer.
I can't help but move back. I know that you have really suffered the outrage.
Oh, no, I haven't suffered.
Well, in the sense, metaphorically, if nothing else, certainly the outrageous slings and arrows of censorship, of being subpoenaed in 1955 by the House.
Easy. Some people really got it tough, and they went to jail, and some people had to change their way of living, and they might have been workers in one industry or something, they had changed to another place where they weren't known. But I've been able to live in the little house my wife and I built 55 years ago. And our neighbors have stuck up for me through all kinds of things, even when lies get printed. For example, the New York Times had a short article saying, Seeger sings anti-American song in Moscow. Well, it wasn't true. And I called up Turner Catledge, the editor at the time, said, gave him the words. And you know, I agree that I didn't know those were the words. I just took the article from the Paris edition of the New York Herald Tribune. And it was a lament for a soldier. And curiously enough, I got it from a letter in my local paper by a woman saying, Dear editor, what's our country coming to? Last month I got a letter from my husband. He's an advisor in Vietnam. He says, it's my own troops I have to watch out for. I sleep with a pistol under my head. And last week, I went down to get his casket coming home. And I just turned it into rhyme. He said, we've no friends here. We've hardly a one. We've got a few generals who just want our guns. But it'll take more than that if we're ever to win. Why, we'll have to flatten the country. It's my own troops I have to watch out for. He said, I sleep with a pistol right under my head. He wrote this last month. Last week he was dead. And Simon came home in a casket. It's one of my better songs. I was quite honored Bernice Stevens sang it once.
I thought one of your better songs also, although there's so many to choose from, was when you sang Waste Deep in the Big Muddy. And I remember, I think the next line is, the big fool said to push on, which was really a reference to Lyndon Baines Johnson policies and the constant immersion, deepening immersion in Vietnam.
Poor Lyndon.
Poor Lyndon indeed.
It was back in 1942, I was a member of a good platoon. We were on maneuvers in Louisiana one night by the light of the moon. The captain told us to ford a river, that's how it all begun. We were knee-deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. The sergeant said, sir, are you sure this is the best way back to the base? Sergeant, go on, I forded this river about a mile above this place. It'll be a little soggy, but just keep slogging, we'll soon be on dry ground. We were waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. The sergeant said, sir, with all this equipment, no man will be able to swim. Sergeant, don't be a nervous Nelly, the captain said to him. All we need is a little determination, men, follow me, I'll lead on. We were neck deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. All at once, the moon clouded over, we heard a gurgling cry. A few seconds later, the captain's helmet was all that floated by. The sergeant said, turn around, men, I'm in charge from now on. And we just made it out of the big muddy with the captain dead and gone. We stripped and dived and found his body stuck in the old quicksand. I guess he didn't know that the water was deeper than the place he'd once before been. Another stream had joined the big muddy about a half mile from where we'd gone. We were lucky to escape from the big muddy when the big fool said to push on. Well, I'm not going to point anymore, I'll leave that for yourself. Maybe you're still walking, you're still talking, you'd like to keep your health. But every time I read the paper, them old feelings come on. We're waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep, neck deep, soon even a tall man will be over his head. We're waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on.
Waist Deep in the Big Muddy. That was previewed on the old Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, which I remember. And I know there was a big hoopla about it. And what I'm interested in is, it's not just that, but certainly you have had the weight of government try to silence you and others like yourself who were a voice of dissent to the policies of war and anti-workerism. Do you see a comparison today? Are you particularly concerned about where we are at and the role of government with Homeland Security, et cetera?
I'm concerned. I've been concerned all my life. I was an early radical. I tell people I became a communist at age 7 when I read about American Indian. They had no rich, no poor, and if there was food, everybody was eating. If there was no food, everybody was hungry, including the chief and his family. And I said, that's the way people should live. Then later on, I read Henry David Thoreau and a great biography by the socialist journalist Lincoln Stephen. So I was in high school, I was a closet lefty. My father, he got radicalized by World War I and was making speeches against imperialist war, and they got fired from a very good job. He was in charge of the music department at Berkeley, California. And when 1929 came along, it seemed to my father, as well as millions of other people, this must be the end of the free enterprise system. And he started working with a lot of other classical musicians. They had what they called the Composers Collective in New York City. Aaron Copland was a member of it, and Mark Blitzstein, and a half a dozen others. And they were trying to figure, what kind of music can we compose so that the proletariat can sing as they march to the barricades? Well, they couldn't have been more mistaken. The proletariat was not interested in their songs. My father found a Kentucky miner's wife living in New York and brought her around to the collective to sing some of her songs. I am a union woman, just brave as I can be. I do not like the bosses, and the bosses don't like me. And they said, Charlie, this is interesting, but this is music of the past, and we're supposed to be creating the music of the future. He took Aunt Molly Jackson back to her little apartment, said, Molly, I'm sorry they didn't understand you, but I know some young people that are going to want to learn your songs, and I guess I was one of them. I was a teenager then. And he took me down to a square dance festival in the southern mountains. I suddenly realized what a world of music there was, which you never heard of up north. And then, of course, in 1940, I met Woody Guthrie, and my life was never quite the same since.
What did he do to you?
What?
What did Woody Guthrie do to you?
Well, he was very simple. He was a small-town intellectual. His father had been moderately rich at one time, then lost everything. You know, it was an oil boom town, and then later, boom bust. And Woody did a lot of reading. He read voraciously. And then when he went to California with a lot of other Okies, he made up songs like the Do-Re-Mi and So Long It's Been Good to Know You. And he had this genius of being able to combine humor and tragedy all in one song. And I just wanted to learn from him. He said about me, he says, that's Seeger. He's the youngest man I ever knew. He don't drink, don't smoke, don't chase girls. But he ended up staying in New York, where he met a lot of interesting people, and we sang together in a group called Almanac Singers for a while. I was there when he wrote the song Reuben James. He read in the newspapers about it and made up a song about 40 verses long. He wanted to have the name of every man who was drowned in it. And we said, Woody, nobody but you is ever going to sing that song. It's got too many verses. And why don't you give us at least a chorus we can sing? And he grumbled, but after a week he came in and he did the job. He cut down the verses to 4 or 5 wonderful verses and gave us a great chorus which is still sung. What were their names? Tell me, what were their names? Did you have a friend on the good Reuben James? Oh me, what a tragedy. He died so young. Well, rather, he went to the hospital at age 40 and never got out.
Was Reuben James, is that a song of the Spanish Civil War? Is that about that?
Oh, no, that was the opening of World War II. It's actually written in, the Reuben James went down in October of 41, And he finally got the finished song, I think, after Pearl Harbor. I think it was in January that he finally got the song finished.
You collaborated with Woody Guthrie with the Almanac Singers, right?
Yeah.
An album that I sort of grew up with, the Talking Union album?
That was made when the Almanacs consisted of me and Lee Hayes and his roommate Millard Lampel, who later became quite a well-known Hollywood scriptwriter. And, of course, they both passed on now. I'm still here at age 85.
Pete, at this point, I saw a comment or a quote from you that said you're really happiest if you get a crowd singing so loud they don't even want to hear you. Well, of course, we always do want to hear you, but what is the power of song that you have brought to us and the choruses that you have allowed or encouraged us to participate in? What does it mean for the human spirit? What has it done also for you?
Well, I think the future of the human race depends on our realizing that we must participate. And the terrible thing about television is that so many Americans are being turned into spectators, 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 spectators. And I don't know what to do about it exactly, except to keep on trying to persuade people that the human race will not last unless we learn how to participate. The worst thing about American politics is the worst thing, and I mean really the worst thing, is the fact that so few people vote. There's a whole lot of people saying, oh, why bother voting? And I don't care whether they vote one way or another, but vote. I don't think I approve of the New Zealand thing. You get fined if you don't vote.
And we're going to hear another song from you now. And for this May Day, what is your choice?
I think I'd take We Shall Not Be Moved, because this old gospel song used to be called Jesus Is My Leader, I Shall Not Be Moved, and West Virginia miners, black miners brought up from the South after the Civil War, changed the words and made a great union song out of it. Harmonized easily.
It's a wonderful
quoted
song.
Quoted all the time, just like a tree that's standing by the waters. We shall not be moved.
We shall not be moved, just like a tree that's standing by the water. We shall not be moved.
The Union is behind us.
We shall not be moved.
The Union is behind us.
We shall not be moved, just like a tree that's standing by the water.
We will stand and fight together.
We shall not be moved, just like a tree that's standing by the water. We shall not be moved. We shall not be moved. We shall not be moved, just like a tree.
Black and white together,
we shall not be moved, just like a tree that's standing by the water. We shall not be moved. We shall not be moved. We shall not be moved, just like a tree that's standing by the water. We shall not be.
Maybe you could tell us a story of solidarity forever.
Well, Ralph Chaplin, he was a kid, a teenager, when he threw a rock through a bank window. And he was an organizer for the industrial workers of the world. And somewhere along, I think he was singing for miners in West Virginia, or organizing, and he got the idea of the chorus. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. This was around World War One. I don't know. I guess before World War One, it might have been 1912 or something like that. And somebody said, you ought to get verses. So they kept after him. If they hadn't kept after him, he never would have gotten the song written. But they, you got to make verses for that. That's a good chorus. So he made up the verses, and it rapidly spread. And even the conservative labor unions still sing the chorus. They don't sing all the verses. In fact, they don't even sing one verse, I think. But they'll sing the chorus.
What is your favorite verse?
In our hands is placed a power greater than their hoarded gold, greater than the might of armies, I yield him, greater might than the might of atoms, magnified a thousandfold. We can bring to birth a new world from the ashes of the old. The Union makes us strong. I disapprove of this verse, at least in one line. They don't care if there's ashes of the world. It's going to be very hard to create a new world out of ashes.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Absolutely.
What about We Shall Overcome?
Well, that's a good song, too. Incidentally, that song is older than we thought. For 40 years, I thought that the slow version of the song was made up by tobacco workers in Charleston, South Carolina, in 1946. You see, there's the old gospel song was, I Will Overcome. I'll overcome. I'll overcome. I'll overcome someday. And very rhythmic. And in the tobacco workers sang it, we will overcome. However, about 3 years ago, a man in Pennsylvania wrote a book called The Challenge of Interracial Unionism. And he reports on black and white coal miners in Alabama singing, and he sent me a Xerox of the front page of the United Mine Workers Journal of February 1909. And a big letter, a long letter, on the front page says, in that strike last year, we opened every strike meeting with a prayer and singing that good old union song, We Will Overcome.
In 1994, you received honors at the Kennedy Center in Washington. I can't help but ask what that experience was like.
I can just laugh.
What did it mean? What did it feel like after so much of the protest and dissent against policies of government to have that recognition?
Well, all I can do is laugh.
I guess that's a statement in and of itself. Well, as we wrap up this interview, certainly for those of us who live in New York, one of the remarkable things that you've done is through your environmental concerns, you have helped us understand a good deal more about the need to clean the Hudson with that wonderful, wonderful sailing vessel, the Clearwater. You must feel very good that there really have been strides made to clean it up.
My wife and I are deeply proud. All we did was plant seeds, and it was the thousands of young people who came along and did the job. I have to laugh. The captain of the Clearwater quoted a line from Eric Hoffer, who was a very reactionary philosopher, but he said, creativity is nice, but maintenance is the essential art of civilization. And it's the people who've maintained the Clearwater for 35 years now, and we're both very proud. We started this back way, way back, almost 40 years ago. It was in 63. Somebody loaned me a book about these beautiful sailboats that carried cargo in the 19th century. And in 66, we had a first fundraising party. I think 160 people came to somebody's lawn, and I sang them some Hudson River songs. They passed the hat and got $160. And in the man's living room, we started a little ad hoc committee to look into the idea of building one of these boats life-size, not half-size. And now they're going to make it a part of the National Historic Place.
Wow, that's wonderful.
No, we're very lucky to be still here in view of all the dangers. And as I say, there's going to be a lot of other terrible things happening, but these all come under the heading of warnings, And the human race has got to realize the danger we're in. And scientists have got to realize the danger, and politicians have got to realize the danger. Teachers, and what may save the race are millions upon millions, hundreds of millions of small things all around the world. In different communities, there are some people trying to do some small thing for their community, often getting together with children. Let's do this. Like the community gardens in New York. There are 800 community gardens in New York City, and there should be several thousand of them. Havana has about 8,000 community gardens, but they had to form. When Soviet support vanished about 15 years ago, the government said, if you want to eat, start a garden.
Pete Seeger, musician, singer, songwriter, folklorist, labor activist, environmentalist, and peace advocate. What song would you like to take us out with on this May Day to unify and create that great global movement of the working class to fight for all the things that you have stood for in your life?
Reid, you're going to have to decide on the song.
So unfair.
When people ask me what's my favorite song, I say that's like asking a mother, what's your favorite child?
Not your favorite song, just a song you think that helps build some real sense of unity for this May Day.
We Shall Overcome could be. I'm quite proud that two verses I made for that are quite widely sung. We'll walk hand in hand and the whole wide world around someday.
We shall overcome, we shall overcome, we shall overcome someday. Oh, deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome someday. We'll walk hand in hand.
People taught us all a lesson.
We are not.